This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. And by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You can say this for the $3 trillion federal budget the president proposed today. He is giving Congress plenty of time to pick it apart. The 2009 fiscal year doesn't even start till the beginning of October, and Democrats aren't wasting any time at all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by Unity Productions Foundation, presenting Prince Among Slaves, a documentary about an African prince enslaved in the American South, tonight at 10 Eastern on PBS.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. It is the 4th of February today. $3.1 trillion is technically the magic number, a bit more than $1.5 trillion in mandatory spending. Those are programs the president's obliged to fund, whether he likes it or not. Minus interest payments and a few other assorted line items, that leaves the White House with about $1.2 trillion to spend at its discretion. So, what are we getting for all that money? From Washington Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The president did save some money by posting the budget online. The White House usually prints 3,000 copies.
It's on a laptop notebook. It's an e-budget.
But Democrats joked the president couldn't print the budget because he ran out of red ink. The president's budget is swelling the deficit to pay for a stimulus package, plus increases in the Homeland Security and defense budgets. To offset that, the White House is basically freezing domestic programs. And House Budget Committee Chair John Spratt says the budget doesn't even include the full costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We've got substantial defense costs for which we decided we would not pay now. We'd simply let the tab go to the future generations.
The budget surpluses of the Clinton era are gone now. In recent years, the government has spent more on the Medicare prescription drug program. Now we're spending two-thirds of our money on Social Security, Medicare, and debt repayments. On the campaign trail, President Bush said he was all for small government. He promised to tackle Social Security. But budget analyst Stan Collender says he ran into a wall.
Most of what's in the budget has substantial political support. And even with a Republican House and Senate, he was unable to make a lot of the changes that he wanted or would have liked in a perfect world.
President Bush is still trying to force some changes. He'd whack $196 billion out of Medicare and Medicaid by cutting payments to doctors and hospitals. But the ranking Republican on the House Budget Committee, Paul Ryan, doubts Congress will go for that.
Everybody's afraid that the other political party will use the reforms against them, and so you have a standoff now.
And nobody's standing down, especially in an election year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Lights, camera, and maybe action. That's the latest from the Hollywood labor wars. Talks between the Writers Guild and the studios are said to be going well. Well enough that there is speculation the strike could end this week. Grey's Anatomy and all the rest won't be back on the air right away, but the entertainment industry is rushing to get back to business as usual, as Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Writers are dutifully walking the picket line today, but behind the scenes, networks are gearing up to get scripted shows back on the air. Word of a possible resolution to the strike has studios scrambling to lock down shooting locations and former staff. They want to be prepared when the strike ends. TV critic Aaron Barnhart says there's good reason to rush.
If you don't get these shows back in production by the end of February, you pretty much lost the rest of the television season. It'd be almost impossible for these scripted shows to get fresh episodes for the all-important May ratings sweep period.
That's when a show's ratings are calculated and ad rates are set. But getting new episodes on the air won't be easy.
Putting together any kind of show is like assembling an army.
Entertainment analyst Tom Taylor says reigniting an entire industry and putting 11,000 people back to work doesn't happen overnight.
You can't just turn on the switch again. There's a lot of forces that are going to have to be mobilized, both on the production side and on the network side, on how they're going to continue the marketing efforts for the shows. It's going to be a kind of rocky process at first.
Adding to the pressure is the fact that TV viewership has been waning. Taylor points out that the writer's strike pushed declines into the double digits. And with so many other media competing for our attention, he says, networks will be putting a lot of energy into saving heroes, reviving Grey's Anatomy, and getting people to talk about Gossip Girl.
Good. Things are getting a little dull around here.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Microsoft's proposed purchase of Yahoo turned into a three-way fight over the weekend when Google interjected itself into the deal. Janet Babin's following that story for us from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio. Hey, Janet.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. Listen, I never thought we'd say that Google is afraid of anything, but it sure looks like that here, doesn't it?
Hard to believe, isn't it? Because we all think of Google as the leader. We use Google to search every day, many of us. But Google is afraid of Microsoft and Yahoo together. These two companies together could be a real threat. Yahoo has more inventory than Google, more web pages, so you've got millions of people visiting Yahoo pages each day. Plus, Yahoo and Microsoft together lead in instant messaging and email, and the two companies really own display and brand advertising. Those are the banner ads you see on the internet, those big blocks of images online, or the video ads that you see on the internet. And brand advertisers love those ads. So Google might lead in text ads and search, but the company's been desperate to get into these banner ads and display ads, so this would give them that opportunity.
Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer was out and about today making the rounds. He had a piece in the Journal. He did an interview with them. He's been talking to analysts as well. What's he saying and what's the message?
Well, Ballmer told analysts today that the acquisition of Yahoo would actually raise competition, not eliminate it. Over the weekend, Google said that the deal would possibly stifle innovation and competition on the internet. So this was kind of Ballmer reacting to that. But clearly, Microsoft is making the rounds saying this is a good deal for everyone involved. We want this to happen. Another Microsoft official said he expects the deal to be done by the end of the year. But the analyst I spoke to today said that's because the company really needs Yahoo. They've been throwing millions of dollars at the problem of what to do, how to beat Google, and they've been losing ground. So this is their chance to make that up.
Yahoo has been publicly silent, but you have to believe they're talking to people about their options. What can they conceivably do now?
Well, Yahoo is apparently looking around, like you said, for any option. I mean, historically, Yahoo thinks of itself as defining the internet, whereas Microsoft to Yahoo is this stodgy company that doesn't get it. So they're looking for options. And over the weekend, Google and Yahoo CEOs had discussions with each other. And there's a strategy afoot that would save Yahoo from Microsoft. And I spoke to Charlene Lee at Forrester Research about this. She says Yahoo might just give up search altogether and focus on its strong points.
They could potentially outsource their search technology and also the search advertising to Google and therefore be able to get higher revenues, reduce costs, and improve the bottom line to stave off this takeover offer from Microsoft.
Also, Kai, that strategy would be a great business deal because it wouldn't be an acquisition. It would just be a business deal, and it wouldn't be subject to antitrust issues the way the deal between Microsoft and Yahoo might be.
All right, before we get the lawyers involved here, are you going to stop using Google anytime soon?
It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
That's my point. That's my point. Janet Babin at the Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you.
Banks and credit card companies were the drags on the markets today. Technology didn't help much either. We will have the details when we do the numbers. One day before Super Tuesday, Arizona Senator John McCain has made a new pitch to voters. At a rally in Boston today, the Republican presidential candidate promised to come up with specific policies to turn the economy around. Said he's going to do it by, quote, unleashing the forces of the free market. That right there might be the clearest point of distinction yet between the Republican and Democratic hopefuls in the race. And with the economy topping the list of issues that voters are concerned with, it could spell trouble for the GOP. Jeremy Hobson reports.
Todd Crost, who lives outside Detroit, is a lifelong Republican. But this year, he and his wife, who both work and make about 60 grand between them, are planning to vote for a Democrat, someone who's addressing their economic concerns. He says all they're hearing from Republican candidates are biographies.
I'm not so much concerned about that as I am our pocketbook and, you know, what my family's going to do for the next couple of years.
Same goes for Carly Cummings, a small business owner and lifelong Republican from Omaha, Nebraska.
Well, I am for less government, but I am also for taking care of everyone and making sure that just that we look out for our fellow man. So I feel like there is more compassion and just more foresight economically on the Democratic side to be able to reach out to a broader variety of people.
The problem for Republican candidates is not just limited to Todd and Carly. It extends to what former Bush speechwriter David Frum calls the middle-middle. Traditionally, Republican suburban or exurban families making about $70,000 a year. Scott Keeter of the Pew Research Center has the numbers to prove it.
Over the past few years, we have seen a very large partisan gap in ratings of the national economy. We are now seeing that gap declining somewhat, as more Republicans are saying that they don't think the economy is doing well.
So traditionally, Republicans have said the economy is doing fine under this Republican president, and now they're starting to break away and sound more like Democrats.
That's right.
Keeter says people are even taking the unusual step of changing their party affiliation, and he says that change is happening most among middle-class voters.
People tell us they're struggling with the cost of health care and health insurance, the job market in certain places. Increasingly, we're hearing concerns about housing.
Matthew Dowd, who was the chief strategist for the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign in 2004, says this middle-middle is vital.
It's a body of voters that are looking for a candidate and candidates to sort of speak to their where they are today and their future.
Can you win without these people?
If you can, it would be a shocking development to think you can win without these voters. In almost every single election that I can think of, whether it's for governor, for senator, for Congress, for president, the candidate that carries these voters wins.
Dowd says it's the message. Republicans are still talking about endless tax cuts when they need a new playbook.
But I still don't know if they're fully awake to the problem that is brewing out there among the middle class.
Rob Autry is fully awake to it. He's a partner at Public Opinion Strategies, a Republican polling firm. He says there's been a paradigm shift. American voters now see a greater role for government than they did in the Reagan era. And it's time for candidates to speak to that.
Talking about education, talking about government spending and cracking down on wasteful spending, health care, and Republican candidates at the presidential level are talking about health care and controlling cost, talking about the issues that impact the pocketbooks of middle-class voters. I think Republicans have to get back to doing that.
If they don't, he says, some Republicans are fearing a huge swing in the pendulum of power, a la 1980 and the Reagan Revolution. And he says it could take quite a while for the party to undo that. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We're going to begin a short series of commentaries today, more on the topic of economic philosophy than anything else. Charles Handy founded the London Business School, the first of its kind in the UK. He's been near the top of the list of experts in the study of business management for decades. Mr. Handy is going to be spending the next couple of months at Claremont Graduate University's Drucker School of Management. And while he's there, he'll be sending along his impressions of economics in America.
Now that I am sitting where the great Peter Drucker walked and talked, I wonder how he would have reacted to some of the things that bother me. For instance, how would he respond to what I call Adam Smith's great conundrum? Adam Smith, the father of economics, 250 years ago, said, "An investment is by all right-minded people to be commended, because it brings comforts and necessities to the citizenry. But if continued indefinitely, it will lead to the endless pursuit of unnecessary things." Now that I am living for a while in California, I am staggered by the amount of unnecessary things that I see in the malls that dot the suburbs. America is no different from anywhere else, of course, just more so. The conundrum is this. All that stuff creates jobs, making it, promoting it, selling it. It's literally the stuff of growth. What I'd love to ask Peter Drucker is, how do you grow an economy without the jobs and taxes that these unnecessary things produce? Drucker saw business as the agent of progress. Its main responsibility, he said, was to come up with new ideas and take them to market. But not just any new ideas, please. Only those that bring genuine benefits to the customers and do not muck up the environment. The market, unfortunately, does not differentiate between good and bad. If the people want junk, the market will provide. So we have to fall back on the conscience of our business leaders. Maybe they should all be required to sign the equivalent of the Hippocratic Oath that doctors used to be required to swear, including the commitment, above all, do no harm. No, it couldn't be a legal requirement, just an indication of a cultivated responsibility. To my question, then, I like to imagine Peter Drucker nodding assent and saying, "Yes, I have always insisted that business exists to serve society, not to muck it up."
Charles Handy is the Distinguished Drucker Fellow at the Drucker School of Management at Claremont Graduate University. His new book is called Myself and Other More Important Matters. You can send us your thoughts online. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, a snack in Berlin just might have the makings of a copyright, or it might not.
The sausage itself is not a Berliner currywurst. It needs something additionally to become a currywurst.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks took a breather today. The Dow Industrials fell 0.8%, 108 points to close at 12,635. NASDAQ dropped 1.25%, 30 points, to close at 2382. The S&P 500 moved down 1%, 14 points, met the bell at 1380. American Express slowed almost 4% after UBS analysts downgraded its stock from a buy to a sell. Wells Fargo also got a sell recommendation, that one from Merrill Lynch. The nation's fifth largest bank hemorrhaged 6.75% on the news. Investors were completely unimpressed with Google's grumbling over the potential merger between Microsoft and Yahoo. The web giant saw its shares flop 4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee discusses veterans' disability compensation. The nominating race is on as voters hit the polls in 24 states during Super Tuesday. And it's not only Super, but Fat Tuesday. Revelers get serious in New Orleans for the final day of Carnival. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We get about half of all the electricity we use in this country from coal-fired power plants. Generating all that power generates a lot of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide mostly. At the moment, there aren't any federal limits on carbon emissions. Some big investors think it's only a matter of time before there are, though. So today, Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley announced new rules for how they're going to be financing those utilities. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
If the government puts a price on greenhouse gas emissions, utility companies will have to buy allowances to offset the pollution they create. Dan Esty is director of the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. He says that's bad news for investors.
The utilities, which are very heavily coal-dependent in particular, might really become less economically viable. And I think the banks are saying, gee, we want to really think hard before that's where our money is going.
He says banks could be on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars if utility companies default on their loans. Mark Brownstein is with Environmental Defense. His group worked with the banks to come up with a set of guidelines called the Carbon Principles.
It's a series of steps that requires you to take a look at energy efficiency and renewables.
He says some companies may decide they can't run on an energy-efficient or renewable energy platform. Then they'd need a plan B, which could include storing emissions underground.
Looking at the ability of the plant to capture its carbon dioxide and geologically sequester it.
By drawing up these guidelines, the banks are facing the inevitable, says Yale's Dan Esty. They don't want to find themselves exposed when there's a change in the law.
It goes further to the argument that there is an economic logic to beginning to take seriously climate change.
He says this doesn't mean carbon-exposed companies won't be able to find investors in future, but financial firms, including private equity, will want to find a way to reduce their risk or get paid for it. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Risk has been the byword of most of the stories about Wall Street the past 6 months or so. Everything from huge corporate investments like the ones Ashley was just telling us about, down to subprime mortgages, too. Nobody has been able to figure out how much risk they can tolerate. So instead, they've just stopped lending money altogether. Today, the credit crunch hit 160,000 Citigroup customers over in England. The bank's going to shut down their accounts because they are bad risks. We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to look into whether American consumers might be the next to lose their plastic privileges.
Citigroup bought a British bank called Egg last spring. With the acquisition, Citigroup inherited over 2 million credit card customers. About 7% of them had missed payments in the past or had other credit problems. Adrian Russell is a spokesman for Egg.
We're very sorry, but we don't want to lend them any new money, or we don't want them to borrow any new money from us. Apart from that, nothing's changed. They won't be able to use the card for new purchases, but we're not asking for immediate repayment.
Russell says the purge is a one-time event, but some observers consider the case as a test for what banks might do in the U.S.
I think it's definitely a trend that can extend in the U.S.
That's Nomi Prinz with the public policy think tank Demos. She says many U.S. financial institutions have problems with their credit card customers. Prinz expects credit card debt will be the next crisis to follow the subprime mortgage mess.
Once people couldn't pay their mortgages, depleted their home equity loan lines, the next place they went to look for money was in credit cards, and that will be the next place that feels the pain.
Prinz thinks banks will take a second look at their credit card customers, but risk won't be the determining factor. She says the banks evaluate customers in terms of how many fees they generate. So if you're behind in your payments, but you make the payments, don't fear. The banks love your late fees. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wendy's reported fourth quarter profits today. The burger chain made money, just not as much as everybody thought they would. High gas prices and a slowing economy have cut into consumers' tastes for Frosties and square hamburgers. We heard from Yum Brands after the bell. Lower earnings there, too. Yum is the parent company of Pizza Hut and Taco Bell. Those are the think outside the bun guys. In this country, there are brand names and slogans like that one galore to help consumers find their way around fast food nation. Some German marketers of a particular kind of sausage wish they were so lucky. From Berlin, Brett Neely reports.
In Berlin, you're rarely more than 5 minutes walk from a stand selling currywurst. It's basically fried sausage, ketchup, and curry powder. There's usually two serving options, with or without intestines. It's an acquired taste. But at $2 or less, it's a cheap snack. This stand, a few blocks from my apartment, has been serving currywurst since 1961. Owner Oskar Lange tells me how it's done.
First spiced, grilled, spiced, then cut up, then ketchup over it, Worcestershire, and whatever else you like.
Berliners claim that currywurst was invented here in the post-war 40s when food was scarce. It quickly became a German tradition.
You can eat it for the theater, after the opera, with the dinner jacket, with a ball robe, and so on. And everybody eats a currywurst.
Simon Schiller runs the Berlin Butchers Guild. Even Germany's former chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, used to stop his limo in front of a currywurst stand on his way home from work. But Schiller says the traditional Berlin currywurst is in danger.
Producers from outside can produce Berliner currywurst in another country or in another town and bring it to Berlin, and then you can sell it as Berliner currywurst.
She says there's been an influx of cheap sausage from the new Eastern European members of the European Union. So Berlin butchers have applied to trademark the term Berliner currywurst, essentially a geographic trademark. Think champagne from the Champagne region of France or Serrano ham from Spain. You can only sell those products if they're from that region. European law protects hundreds of such products, and it's one of the few loopholes out of Europe's open markets. If the butcher's application is approved, it would mean that only butchers from Berlin would be allowed to sell meat for any product called Berliner currywurst anywhere in the EU. Or maybe not.
The sausage itself is not a Berliner currywurst. It needs something additionally to become a currywurst. You see, you can take this ground sausage for the currywurst, you can take it and eat it with mustard, and then it's certainly not a Berliner currywurst.
Axel Nordemann is an attorney with Bomert & Bomert, one of Germany's top intellectual property law firms. He says it's the sauce, not the sausage, that makes the dish, and trademark law won't protect the sauce. This issue won't be resolved until the German Patent Office makes its final decision. That's at least 2 years away. Nordemann says for the average consumer, this isn't a cliffhanger. He cites a German idiom to make his point. It literally translates as, it's all sausage to me.
It somehow expresses that you don't care.
The question is, even if Berlin's butchers succeed in protecting their sacred sausage, will German consumers care enough to buy Berliner currywurst? In Berlin, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we let you go today. First of all, go Giants. Second of all, go Giants. But even Pats fans have to admit it was a great game. The most watched Super Bowl ever, say the people at Nielsen. More than 97 million of us tuned in. Kind of makes the $2.7 million advertisers dropped for a 30-second spot seem like money well spent, doesn't it? Today did some damage to the Super Bowl indicator, though. It says, as we mentioned Friday, that if a team from the NFC, like the Giants, wins, it'll be an up year on Wall Street. Didn't happen today. Yes, it's only the first day after, but still not a promising start. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow dropped 108 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq slipped 30 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 declined 14 points. That's about 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, Netscape is a has-been now, but ages ago, it was huge.
And then we just watched it throughout the day go up and up and up and up. We had never seen a phenomenon like that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.